So like everything seems like practice does make perfect, even in entrepreneurship, even in starting companies. Like your first company may be a failure. Your second company might be, you know, a $5 million outcome. Your third company might be a $50 million outcome. And it's your fourth company that becomes that, you know, $10 billion outcome that you're looking for. So like everything, practice makes perfect. And that's why age doesn't correlate, because we have 22-year-olds who have started a company before and sold it. And we have 50-year-olds who have never started a company before, right? So that's why, you know, age by itself does not matter. A lot of things that are correlated with age sometimes matter.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Ali Tamaseb, a partner at DCVC, a venture capital firm with over $2 billion under management and with investment in more than $10 billion startups. He holds leadership and board director positions at multiple companies, including Carbon Health, Medical Informatics, and PlotLogic. In this episode, Ali gives us a sneak peek into his new book, Super Founders: What Data Reveals About Billion-Dollar Startups. He debunks the myth of what makes a good founder or a successful company and reveals the simple commonality at the core of all entrepreneurs. Here's our conversation. Welcome, Ali. Thank you for joining me this afternoon.
I'm glad to be here, Christine.
That's great. How's your 2021 so far? I mean, I feel like with your book as coming out, it seems you're, despite the pandemic, 2020 has been a very productive year for you.
For sure. Yeah, I'm glad you're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. Things are hopefully going to get back to normal soon. And yeah, it's been a crazy busy year with both the book and, you know, generally the investment activities is very active. A lot of companies are raising money. A lot of companies are, you know, getting some levels of success. So it's an exciting time, but it's also hard to do both of them together.
Right, that's true. But definitely time management must be one of your key strengths. So, but I thought before we start talking about your book, which I'm really excited, and I love the title, by the way, The Super Founders. If you can share with us your background and the path that you took to become an investor and an author.
For sure. So I'm a partner at DCVC. DCVC is a Silicon Valley-based venture capital firm, with over $2 billion under management. They've been around for the past 10 years. We invest in the hard stuff, so companies that are solving complex engineering or scientific problems. They typically don't invest in like the SaaS companies or the consumer apps or consumer goods companies in the world. We try to invest in, you know, anywhere from rockets to space to therapeutics to diagnostic tools, to manufacturing, you know, mining, a lot of different areas. And we have a DCVC Bio Fund, which is specifically for bio-related companies. You know, some of our companies in our portfolio include, you know, Accelera, Carbon Health, Freenome, Recursion Pharma, Zymergen, Pivot Bio. That's kind of mostly in the bio and biology and healthcare. And then we have, you know, Planet Labs, Rocket Lab, in the space, SentinelOne, Illumio in the cybersecurity space. So kind of a wide range of hard tech, deep tech companies. We have over 10 unicorns in these spaces. I personally look at a lot of healthcare companies within DCVC as well as other industries. So I sit on the board of Carbon Health, which is a unicorn now, employs over 1,500 people, plus a number of cryptocurrency or blockchain companies and mining technology companies.
That's a very different.
It is. And, you know, I'm a person investor. That's why I don't necessarily have a sector focus. Like a lot of people have thesis areas that they go after. My thesis area is people. And my thesis driven investment is on people. And, kind of the idea of this book, this goes back to about 4 years ago, a little bit more now, back in 2016, 2017. I started to think about this question of, you know, what is it that actually differentiates billion-dollar, massively successful companies with the rest? You know, 90-something percent of companies either fail or become, you know, stale. And is there anything inherently different about them on day one? I'm not saying after 2 years, what was your growth or how things changed. Like day one, fundamentally about this company, this idea, this team, was there something different? And you hear a lot from everybody, from VCs, from startup mentors, from advisors, from former entrepreneurs. And everybody talks from their own personal experience. Everybody talks from their own personal anecdotes that they've seen, the one or two experiences that they've had. And they say these things. They, you know, some people say solo founders don't work, like don't start a company solo. Or some people say you need to be a technical founder to start a company. Some people say don't invest in MBAs. Some people say do invest in MBAs. And things are cyclical and things change. And there's a lot of things, you know, you should be solving your personal problem. You should be, you know, going and creating a new market. You need to be starting in this type of a market. There's a lot of things people say, and I just want to scream because it's not data-backed. Like people are talking about their gut and the one or two experiences they've had, and it was driving me crazy. And I come from an academic background where I have done research and I've published papers and, you know, was used to that kind of different model of thinking of being more, you know, suspicious when you look at data or, you know, stories or anecdotes. So kind of that drove me into writing this book, or actually starting the data collection project. So it took me only a year and a half to write the book, but it took me 4 years to collect that data that is the backbone of this book. And the data is 30,000 data points, which is on 65 different elements on each company, anywhere from the founders, their career, their background, what they've done before, to the fundraising process, to the idea, to the market, to competition, every element you can think about as a startup. And I collected these 65 data points on all the billion-dollar companies that were founded in the past 15 years, and on a randomly selected selection of companies that did not become unicorn, which were funded with venture capital for over $3 million in these past 15 years. So now I have these two groups. One of them is the baselines, the random group. And then I have the unicorns, the billion-dollar companies. And I can see what actually makes a difference and what does not. And, you know, after I did the research and I collected data, it turns out a lot of these things that people say are wrong are either it's the other way around or are not as statistically, you know, supported. And I published this Medium article back in late 2018. I published some of my findings and that went viral, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people read that article. And kind of that led me to this idea, okay, let me write this book. And I, you know, expanded on the data and I interviewed a lot of people. I interviewed Eric Yuan, founder of Zoom, Tony Fadell, inventor of the iPod and co-inventor for iPhone, founder of Nest, founders of GitHub, and, you know, $15 billion companies, investors like Alfred Lin of Sequoia Capital, Case Raboya Founders Fund, Peter Thiel, plus some people in the healthcare industry. Interviewed the founders of Flatiron Health. I interviewed Ari Baldegrin, who's the founder of basically four massively successful biotech companies, including Kite Pharma and Allogene Therapeutics. And so the book is kind of includes some healthcare and biotech stuff, includes some tech stuff. It's not specific for tech. It's not specifically for biotech. It's everything. It includes, you know, energy companies, hard tech, deep tech, space, whatever space it is, and looks at the more general characteristics of these founders, these ideas, the source of these ideas.
So after interviewing that many people and researching, what are the surprising things that you found, and what are the myths that you thought everybody say turned out to be completely wrong?
Right. It's a lot. I mean, it's a 300-page book. I think every page is like a couple myth busting. So it's a lot of things. And I would promise anyone who goes and orders and reads this book, this is the least repetitive book you'll ever read. You know, you read a lot of business books and, you know, it's one idea repeated for 200 pages. This book is basically 100 different ideas. So anyways, I'll go and, you know, tell you a couple of them. One is, co-founders. Like a lot of people think, okay, Steve Wozniak and, you know, Steve Jobs or Paul Allen and Bill Gates, two co-founders is ideal. It's not. And no specific number of co-founder number is ideal. You can be solo. A lot of people say don't start a company solo. Turns out one out of every five unicorn was solo founded, including Zoom and a bunch of others. A lot of Alibaba, it has 18 co-founders or 18 people with a title of co-founder. There's no correlation between success and number of co-founders. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean is, if you're two people and if you have an amazing third person who wants to join the team, but is asking you, hey, I need to be considered a co-founder to join you, just give them the co-founder title. Like a lot of people think, no, I want to keep the circle, a closed circle, your two founders, but you know, just give that title away. Or a lot of people are solo and, you know, just they try to randomly find somebody to pair up with because they want to apply to an accelerator program. And, you know, you don't have to do it. If you're solo, if you haven't found the right person, just start solo. It's all fine. So that's one. Two, you don't have to solve a personal problem. A lot of people say, you know, you need to be solving your own problem. You need to have experienced this. And a lot of people try to connect these threads. Like in healthcare, it's like my mom had this thing. And in tech, it's like when I was a kid, I was experiencing this, right? And it turns out a lot of these things comes after the fact. Like these founders come, and when I looked at data, these founders and also, you know, the interviews, what you observe is these founders, you know, tried a bunch of different ideas. They spent a year or 2 years looking at different ideas, looking at different, you know, industries, and then they finally came and found an idea that worked. And then they have a mission-driven view of that idea. And then they try to link, oh, actually, I have this cousin that has this problem. Or actually, I have this, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when they're interviewing with media, they kind of try to make these stories. They don't make these stories up. Like they try to make these connections, right? Just to say, okay, it was a personal problem. But it doesn't matter. Like you can be opportunistic and go and find something. You need to be passionate about it. And you need to learn as much as you can about that. But it doesn't need to be your personal problem. And I had interviewed Rachel Carlson of Guild Education, which is an upskilling thing for college, like sending like Starbucks employees to college. And you know, she was a Stanford MBA. It wasn't her personal problem.
Right.
Regardless, she started that. She was successful. It's the same case with Flatiron Health you know, founders. It wasn't their personal problem. They tried 5-6 different ideas, and then they came across Flatiron Health. They didn't even know about real world evidence when they founded Flatiron Health. Like they started a company, everything came after. Industry experience doesn't matter. This thing is the one thing that separates tech and healthcare and biotech. So in tech, 70% of founders of billion-dollar companies, they did not have domain expertise. So you could have been, you know, someone in SaaS building databases, and then you go and build like an insurance consumer app, right? And that's all fine. There's no problem. In healthcare, it's different. 80% of founding CEOs did have experience. They were from the biotech industry, and they were actually from that specific part of the biotech industry. So it seems like for these harder sciences, like space, like biotech, experience seems to matter. Or at least a lot more people, a higher percentage of people were experienced in the domain. But in consumer and in SaaS, and like generally B2B enterprise, a lot of these founders did not have any domain expertise. The other thing is on age. So, you know, there's this famous Harvard Business Review article that I think came out a couple years ago that says, you know, you need to be 45 years old to succeed. And this is also the old view, the old school view, that like the 1990s view, that the older you are, the more successful you are. And then in the past 20 years, I would say we've had the other side of the bias that, you know, you need to be young. You know, look at Zuckerberg, look at Bill Gates.
And you need to drop out.
Right. You need to drop out. You need to be 19 years old to create this massively successful company. And, you know, I've been there. I know a lot of people who've been there. It's like, this is the time. Like, if I don't start a company when I'm like in my second year of undergrad, I will miss out on life, right? This is when I will get my best idea. This is my best chance. And there's a lot of in-betweens. When I looked at the data, there is no correlation between age and success. You can be 60, you can be 18. That doesn't matter. What does matter, and that's the biggest thing, and that's the definition of the super founder, the concept that I get at in the book, is your passion for building projects, your passion for starting companies and getting to a finish line. So if you had founded a company before and that company got a $10 million exit or like a $10 million revenue, which is a good success, but in terms of venture capital and in the world of, you know, billion-dollar acquisitions, it's a very modest outcome. A lot of people in venture capital would consider that a failure, like if you sold your company for $12 million.
Right.
It turns out if you're one of those people, you're about 350% more likely to build a billion-dollar company, your next act, right? So like everything seems like practice doesn't make perfect. Even in entrepreneurship, even in starting companies, like your first company may be a failure. Your second company might be, you know, a $5 million outcome. Your third company might be a $50 million outcome. And it's your fourth company that becomes that, you know, $10 billion outcome that you were looking for. So like everything, practice makes perfect. And that's why age doesn't correlate, because if you have 22-year-olds who have started a company before and sold it, and we have 50-year-olds who have never started a company before, right? So that's why, you know, age by itself does not matter. A lot of things that are correlated with age sometimes matter. The other thing is, again, in a lot of people say PhDs are not good. They are very specific on one thing. They have been, you know, they only know about one thing in their life, and I don't want to invest in them. They're not general. They're not CEO material, right? Turns out there are more PhDs, PhD founder CEOs among billion-dollar companies than dropouts. So it's actually a common thing.
That's good to know for the university.
Exactly, right? Exactly. And obviously that in the world of biotech, in the world of hard tech, in the world of healthcare, there are more people who are with more advanced degrees. When I compared, the education level for people in the healthcare industry and biotech industry was a lot higher than people in the tech industry. The age median was higher. So the median founder of a billion-dollar biotech company was 42 years old when they started that company. The median age of a tech or in general billion-dollar company was 34. Again, this doesn't mean if you're older, you're more likely to succeed in biotech. It just tells you what the average looked like. That's the same median of the companies that got started and founded, right? There's no higher or lower chance. It's just, you know, the distribution of these people.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
What else I can say? There's like the thing about the schools, you know, if you've gone to Stanford and Harvard, you know, you're more likely to succeed, or that kind of that notion. It is true. You are. But basically, when I compare the data, people who started billion-dollar companies were indeed more likely to have gone to better-ranking schools by a large factor. But there's a but here. There were as many people that went to top 10 schools as that many people who went to schools that did not rank in the top 100. So it's like a barbell strategy. There are these people with the perfect resume. They, you know, went to a perfect school, worked at a perfect job, and they started a company and became successful. And then these people who, like, their resumes don't shine. Like, they went to randomish school. They did not work in the Googles or the Facebooks of the world, or whatever the equivalent of that is in the biotech world. But then they started companies. They had this passion for building stuff. They experimented, they built stuff, and they finally got there. And they started building our companies. So it's like a barbell strategy. The middle doesn't work, but you can be the left side or the right side, and those things kind of work.
What do you mean by say the middle doesn't work?
I guess doesn't work is a wrong way to look at it. But when you look at the distribution, there's a lot more people who went to top 10 schools, and there were a lot of people who went to schools that didn't have any brand. There are fewer people who went to a school ranked 75, who went to school ranked 50, right? They were either, the top of the class and everything was like shiny resumes, or they didn't care about that and they built side businesses, they built side hustles, they didn't care about going to the McKinsey's of the world, and they started things on their own. And that's how they built their career. That's how they built their kind of life. Yeah, I guess that's some of the learnings and the surprising facts. As I said, there's a bunch more in the book. There's, I think, 18 chapters in the book, and I go on about fundraising, competition, defensibility, IP, patents, all of these things in the book,
right.
And also talk about how biotech is different from kind of tech.
What is the commonality of all these super founders that? At the core, besides the love of building.
That is it. That's the commonality. They have a bug. They've had a bug for building, like side projects. I was reading this article about the founder of Calm. It's that kind of the meditation app. And I read something like when he was in college, he built this website, which was the $1 million logo webpage. It was one webpage. And he put, one small advertisement, like one logo of a company there, like 1 million logos. And he charged $1 per logo. Mm-hmm. And he made $1 million. That simple, right? that simple. And that's how he paid for college and a lot more and started a bunch of companies afterwards. So it's these, and when you look at these, like Zuckerberg, he seems like a first-time founder. He was 19 when he started Facebook, mm-hmm. right? And he started actually four things before that. He started something like Spotify back in 1999, something that learns your music taste. Obviously, from the Social Network movie, we know about the face match and the course match stuff that he had built. Mm-hmm. So you see that these people had built projects that a lot of people used. Some of them built nonprofits. Some of them built free stuff. Some of them built these crazy stuff like put a website on the internet and get $1 million for putting your logo there. It's these random stuff. It doesn't need to be like a massively successful company that you had ran before and then you start a $1 billion company. It's this bug for building and creating value that is the commonality among these $1 billion founders.
But there's a lot of people who like to build, but then doesn't mean they become a successful builder. So there must be something else that contribute to their success.
You would be amazed. I don't think there's a lot of people who like to build. There's a lot of people who like to talk about building, but I don't think there's a lot of people who actually have that passion for building stuff. And sometimes that's like, if it's a failure, just kind of moving to the next thing or doing these kind of crazy stuff, like that idea of building a web page and putting a logo for $1 and getting like 1 million logo. It's one of these crazy, bizarre ideas that generated money for some people. And I think that's the type of kind of, genius, crazy, simple ideas that generated them a little bit of money. And that's one thing that's shared. And I don't think that there's that many people of that caliber out there that have that kind of passion and rigor for coming up with ideas and building and getting them to a finish line, like making some money online or making some money from selling something, selling baseball cards or selling something. And finally, these people will get there. Like it may start with a failure or two failures and like a small success and a medium success. And, a lot of these people finally get there. And yes, it's a statistics chance, right? At the end of the day, a very small proportion of companies become $1 billion companies. Everything we're talking here is what can increase your chances, right? You're not guaranteed to build a $1 billion company. It's a rare thing. It will remain a rare thing. Even all the news we hear and all the SPACs and all the IPOs that we hear in the news, it's still a very, very small proportion of all the companies that get built.
That's true. Because I think also, otherwise everybody will be billionaire as well. Exactly. There's no value for being the billionaire. But I think investors always like to say that, we want to find CEO that is coachable, somebody who listens to feedback. And And then sometimes, you know, investors like, well, we are seasoned investors, so we see the pattern, what make a good successful CEO or founders. What do you say to that now that you've done all your research?
Right. Yeah. So I, personally, I don't necessarily think that I necessarily want to work with coachable founders. Like I'm not saying I want to work with uncoachable founders, but I will select for founders that I would trust. They know more about their business than I do. And I will strive to invest in founders that don't need my help, but I'll help them anyways. Or I'll find ways to help them from the ways that they don't know about. And I think that the other characteristic that I saw in this, it mostly from the interviews, is this relentlessness and this ability to kind of jump the wall. Like if you see a wall in front of you, you have a lot of resources and you can go, you know, around the wall, you can go through the wall, you can jump on the wall. And a lot of these successful founders, they had the hustle and they had built these resources to be able to jump the wall or break the wall. And I think it's that resourcefulness and which comes from that hustle, that they had hustled before they created these resources for themselves. And now they can jump through different hoops.
As a parent, I think it's so important for parents to try to train their kids to be resilient, have the grit. And do you think it's through nurturing, through coaching, or is it something that they were born with?
That's a hard question to ask. I think the whole point of my book is to be data-driven. So I'm not going to comment on this because I don't have data on it. So I'm not going to talk about my gut feeling about it by stating something I don't necessarily know about. But if I had a piece of advice here, it would be to point the kids towards maybe hobbies that involve a little bit of selling, involve a little bit of making money on your own. And it doesn't even need to be making money directly, but having some element of selling. And, you know, nowadays all the kids are like a lot more tech savvy than we are. They can create websites and they can, you know, if a kid can sell something online, I think that's the best thing they can do. Like if as a hobby, if a kid can try to sell something online, it's ecstatic. It's very exciting. And that kid has a brilliant future.
I feel like now also there's so much more resources for kids at this generation. Of course, there's a lot more pressure and competition compared to when I was growing up. You know,
for most sure.
People just selling lemonade on the street rather than through the World Wide Web. So after doing all this interview and the research, what are the things that change how you invest going forward?
For sure. Yeah, so I think the data has shaped my thoughts, and I hope the way it changes other people's thoughts is two ways. One, and the more important one for our industry, is to put aside these stereotypes that we've had. Put aside these preconceptions and, you know, random thoughts that we have. You know, some people say, I would not invest in you because your two brothers starting a company. And I don't think like your relatives or your married, you know, co-founders. Mm-hmm. Again, data showed that's not relevant. I would not invest because you're a solo founder. I would not invest because you don't or do have an MBA. I would not invest because you do or do not have a PhD. A lot of these things that do not matter, I hope we can put aside and look at the merit of the data and look at the merit of the background of these founders and the team they put together and the business they've created. Or again, on the personal idea, like I would not invest because you have not personally experienced this, right? Or it's not something personal to you. So I hope we, as an industry, we can put these things aside and give people more chance based on what they building now on what they've built before. That's one thing. And I think the way it's changed me is, you know, rather than paying attention to what school somebody went to or what degrees they have or what company they worked at, look at what they built before. Look at what passion projects they've had before. And spend a lot more time kind of digging deep into, you know, what are the things that they've created. And my investment in Carbon Health is kind of one of these investments that was definitely data-driven. And, you know, I got to conviction to invest in this company because of the data. And the founder of Carbon Health, he had previously started Udemy before, which is an online ed tech company. And before that, had started other companies before. So this guy is from Turkey. He never went to, you know, a school in the US or a top school here. Never worked at any very, you know, brand name. And he had multiple failures as, you know, different startups there. And I think even, you know, didn't even last that long within Udemy, right? Mm-hmm. But what is interesting about him is, you know, he has had the passion to build all these stuff, build these side projects, main projects, companies, regardless of where it went to or what level of outcome it had. He has had this passion for building stuff for the past 15 years. And that kind of made me a lot more comfortable with making an investment in this company or leading an investment in this company. And that's kind of the commonality between a lot of my other, you know, investments, is mm-hmm. kind of trying to understand what are the things that these people care about? What are the things that they built before? It doesn't matter. It's a nonprofit, small project. You know, you've sold something online. What are the things that you did before? Rather than, you know, which school you went to or which company you worked at.
Well, that's great. So if I ask you three words for advice for our entrepreneurs who are already building something, what would that be?
Well, you're already on the path. Just like, keep doing what you're doing. Don't expect that your first company is going to become a $1 billion outcome. Learn as much as you can from that experience and, you know, build with the passion and with the aim to make $100 billion company, but don't lower your passion. Don't lower your aim. But if you don't get there, don't be, you know, dissatisfied. Learn from that, build your network from that first experience, build that second company. Hopefully this one would be a larger success and then build that third company. And it's the same thing for investors as well. You know, my ideal investing strategy would be to pick some people and back them, you know, invest in them back to back in their companies until they build that massively successful companies. It's the same thing, you know, pick where you're interested about, build companies or build even product. It doesn't even need to be a company. Like if you're a kid in a school, build a club, build a side project, sell something online, right? Try to do these kind of stuff. And yeah, that would be my, you know, so you're already on your way. If you're starting a company, if you're a founder now, if that's a perfect start.
You are on your way. Okay. Well, yeah. That's great. Well, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to read the book when it's published. It's going to be published in May.
Yes, May 18th. It's out. You can buy on Amazon, Kindle, Audible, Walmart, Target, and it's in many countries, and it will have a bunch of translations as well. So whatever works best for you. Thank you for listening, and hopefully you will get a chance to read the book or listen to it.
That sounds good. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Christine. Glad to be here.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.